Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, we have an open line for you at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, along with the call, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, if you mix your alcohol with diet soda, what will happen to you versus if you mix it with, let's say, cream or a regular soft drink?
What will happen to you?
Yes,
okay,
what will happen
coming
to you?
Up, we'll
talk
what else?
About that. Teen births have plummeted to an amazing low, and so has the birth rate in this country. Let's talk about that, the implications, and how we can help prevent teen births.
Yeah, lots of ramifications for that. What's our recipe?
Roasted pear and popcorn salad. It's sort of snacky in sound, but it's definitely an entree that you might enjoy tomorrow.
Pear and popcorn.
Pear and popcorn.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. To the phones now, Zorba, we welcome a listener in Onalaska, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Good to be talking with you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. How can we help?
Well, I ran into something pretty interesting the other day. I bought some salmon. I think it was from Walmart. And I'm a food label reader. I read the back of the label. And in the ingredients list, I noticed carbon monoxide was the second ingredient. And I just kind of floored me because I thought that was supposed to be a poisonous gas. So I was just wondering, how is that possible? And is this harmful to our health?
Well, this is really interesting. So this was the ingredient on fresh salmon. Is that what it was?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I bought it frozen. It was packaged and distributed from China.
Okay, from China. Okay. Well, first of all, let's talk about carbon monoxide, and then let me give you what I think is going on with the salmon.
Okay.
Carbon monoxide is a poisonous gas. It's poison in that it's odorless, and if you have your car running in your garage, carbon monoxide will build up. It's from incomplete combustion. So if you have a barbecue and you barbecue inside your house, it'll fill with carbon monoxide. That's why people don't barbecue inside their house unless they've got it vented out. And what happens is you breathe that and you don't get oxygen. It's not that it itself is poisonous. It's that when you breathe it in, you don't have oxygen and the result can be poison. But in and of itself, it sort of is poisonous in that we know that people who smoke have higher carbon monoxide levels. There's some questions whether or not that really is implicated in heart attacks. And we know that's, that low-dose carbon monoxide that may occur in the house over time can lead to things such as stroke, a decrease in ability to function and remember things. So that's carbon monoxide there. How do they kill the fish? That's the issue. They must kill the fish with carbon monoxide. In other words, they must take the fish and they must put them in a tank with carbon monoxide. The fish must inhale, that's my guess, the carbon monoxide. And so they have to list that as an ingredient. And perhaps when they package it in the salmon, you know, they package the salmon and they freeze it, they may put carbon monoxide in to keep bacteria from propagating that may destroy the
fish
salmon.
Can take in carbon monoxide underwater?
Well, it may be that that's what they, you know, fish take in oxygen underwater, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's how they breathe. So, I mean, I'm just guessing. This is pure speculation.
Yeah.
They may pump carbon monoxide into the water, and that's how the fish die, with carbon monoxide.
Yeah.
Or they may just package the carbon monoxide in the packaging. And I want to give an example. I had an uncle, Uncle Albert, one of my favorite uncles, in Chicago. He was my godfather. I just loved the guy. And he was a warehouseman, and he had cakes that they had started baking. This is in the 80s. And the cakes lasted for a year and a half in the package because the package had carbon monoxide in the package. I remember that. And so the cakes never deteriorated.
Oh, dear.
So, I mean, it's one of the fun facts that's in the back of my brain. And he took out a cake and he said, look, this was made a year ago. And he opened up this, I remember, tinfoil container. We had a piece of the cake because he had like 10,000 cakes there. And he was able to take some. And it tasted pretty good after a year and a half.
Okay. So.
Anyway, that's what I can say now. The fish comes from China.
Right.
We don't, you know what I mean? It's China. Is it safe?
Right.
It's very, very interesting. You know, I mean, there are a number of people now who will say, look, I don't know what's going on in China, and I don't think the FDA is paying attention, and I'm concerned. On the other hand, we get, like you said, salmon, shrimp. They often come from Southeast Asia, and they're much, you know, they're less expensive than the stuff that's raised here. And so I don't answer questions like that because they're political questions.
But as far as
safety is concerned,
I think it's fine. There's no issue. There's no issue. You're not gonna get carbon monoxide poisoning by doing this, because the carbon monoxide poisoning is when it's in the air for you and you're breathing it in. That's a totally different issue.
So it is safe. All right.
Thanks a lot. Thanks so much for your call.
We appreciate the question. That's really a delicacy, China salmon.
Terrible, Tom. You're just terrible. What are we going to do for international relations if that is spread across the landscape? But we don't have to worry. We don't have to worry. They're probably not listening to us in Beijing.
Probably not. 800-462-7413. On we go now, Zorba, to a listener in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Yes, hello.
How can we help?
Yeah, I've been trying to identify foods that irritate or slow down my energy, and they also happen to be foods that I'm attracted to. So I guess the question is, why would the body be attracted to something that it does not perform well by consuming?
Now, wait a second. So the foods that you like are the ones that disturb you. Is that it? So give me an example.
Well, it's pretty broad. I mean, I would say too much doughy things, breads, glutens. Sugars, simple sugars, and too much meat, and of course too much alcohol.
Well,
but that's obvious.
That's always the case. The bad for us food always tastes better, doesn't it?
Well, that's it. You know, it comes from Aesop. Remember Aesop's fable? You know, with the apple. You know, if you couldn't get the apple, it tasted better. I can't remember the exact fable.
I don't remember that fable.
Well, come on. You know, are you a Greek scholar? You know, you don't necessarily remember. But I mean, I've read his fables. I don't remember which fable it was. But, you know, stolen fruit always tastes better.
Oh, yeah,
that whole concept. What you can't have for some reason is something that we find attractive because we can't have it. There are a couple of issues here, though, that have some scientific basis. The foods you like are generally the foods you eat. And those foods you eat, if you're going to have any GI disturbance, are generally going to be the ones that disturb you because you're eating them. In other words, you're already eating them. And so if you've got a gut problem, of course, these just happen to be the foods that you're eating. You know, for a lot of people, dairy products can be an issue. For other people, gluten, although gluten is a hot thing to have, gluten-free food. A lot of people think that they're gluten intolerant, and they're not, but they feel better when they're on other things. So there may be some other marginal gluten issues that are not what we call SPRU and major problems with people who cannot tolerate wheat products at all. But I think the way to do it is you look at your individual foods, and then you eliminate them. The problem is if they're too many foods, all of a sudden you're on a highly restricted diet, and often I think that can be far worse. So what do you eat now?
Oh, I'm not very restrictive. It's just that I would be attracted to something like, say, candy. And I understand the simple sugar concept where it's, you know, it's quick energy for the body, but then I was confused how I would be so attracted to something that 15 minutes later I would regret.
That's human nature. That is human nature. Being attracted to something that you later regret doing is sort of part of the way life is. It's just one of those things that, you know, I have no explanation for that at all. None at all. But it really is human nature to have that. And once again, it's those things that you're attracted to that often are the things you consume from a food point of view that may not be good for your stomach.
A question for you. If broccoli was unhealthy, do you think you'd be attracted to it?
I have no idea.
Thank you so much for
your call.
All right.
A reminder, we have a very heart-healthy and yummy recipe coming up in a few minutes, so you can have healthy food that tastes good too, as
absolutely
we prove week after week.
And that's what we do. We talk about healthy food that we think is really good, really delicious. It's not simply your tofu diet. You know,
right.
It's a diet that has stuff in it besides tofu. Yeah.
We also have some interesting topics, and here's one right here you mentioned, Zorba, something about diet soda mixed with alcohol.
Well, it's very interesting, and it makes a lot of sense. This was happened to be a study. It was a breathalyzer test, okay? So you take a few drinks, do a breathalyzer test, mm-hmm. and what sort of alcohol content do you have? And breathalyzer is a very rough grade of how much alcohol you actually have consumed and how drunk you actually are. And what they found was that you had straight people drinking straight alcohol. Let's have a shot of Jack, you know, Jack Daniels. Yep. Take a shot straight up. People who have Jack Daniels will say with Coke, okay, regular Coke, mm-hmm. you know, and then people who have, you know, with Coke Zero, you know, which is has no calories at all.
All right.
And what they discovered.
Or Diet Coke.
Yeah, well, Coke Zero is like Diet Coke. Yeah. So first of all, what they found was that in the alcohol content in your breath, which really is similar to what you're going to find in the bloodstream, is going to be a certain amount with the drink, okay, the straight up drink. That's going to be sort of the highest. But it was almost as high when you mix it with Diet Coke, for instance, a diet drink, but it was lower if you mixed it with a regular drink. So here's the issue. Mm-hmm. When alcohol goes into your body and into your stomach, you know, if you drink on an empty stomach, I notice that I'm much more inebriated very quickly. And the reason is food slows down gastric emptying and therefore slows down the absorption of alcohol within your body. And when you're mixing it with a regular drink, there is sugar in that. That's food to your body.
Oh.
And so the stomach slows down basically how it empties, and therefore the inebriation is not quite as fast and as quick. So you might be drinking a diet soda, and that's the same to your body as drinking a shot straight up.
Got it. So it's not diluted very much.
It's not diluted with calories.
Yeah,
when it's diluted with calories, you don't get as drunk. In other words, I mean, you can get as drunk, of course, if you drink alcohol, but I mean, you don't get immediately as inebriated. It's not the sudden surge of alcohol to your brain.
Yeah.
And if you're mixing it with, if you're having a diet drink at a bar or two diet drinks, you're basically drinking an alcoholic beverage on an empty stomach.
I just hope our listeners, I know these are public radio, I hope our listeners aren't using this to determine that they can have a lot of booze
with a
regular drink and not so much.
No, you still get just – if you have three drinks, you're going to have the same blood alcohol level a half an hour later. It's going to be exactly the same thing. However, the shooting up of that blood alcohol level is going to be quicker with the straight-up drink or the diet drink. But
so
the amount of alcohol –
this is just an immediate
– right. It's how quick it is, how immediate it is, how you're going to act. But the amount of alcohol in your bloodstream, we'll say, half an hour later is going to be the same.
Got it.
Whether it's mixed with the diet soda, straight up, or that. In other words, you're going to have just as much alcohol, but you're going to have a sudden surge if you mix it with a diet drink.
So this is just an interesting, quirky little thing with no actual practical implications.
I think it does. It does. You know, if you look at the way the Europeans consume their alcohol, they consume it with food. So they consume it, and it's what you get from alcohol, which is a more relaxed feeling. They consume it with food is slower. But if you take a drink straight up on an empty stomach, at least you get more inebriated quicker, and you may do dumb and stupid things.
Uh-huh. No. 800, not our listeners. 800-462-7413. It's toll-free. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, to a listener in Iron River, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Very good to be on your program today.
Good to have you. What's up?
And Tom, thank you for your concern. Being from northern Wisconsin, we already know those facts, how quickly to get inebriated. Anyway... The previous caller is a good segue to my question, which has to do with the diagnosis of celiac disease. And my symptoms started a year and a half ago with persistent diarrhea. And I finally went in to have some tests done and came back negative for bacteria. I had been in the Boundary Waters canoe area that summer before, and I thought it was maybe related to that, but it was not. And then during that interview with the physician's assistant said possibly a gluten issue, possibly lactose. And I asked about gluten, and when she said I'd have to give up beer, well, I think my hearing shut off at that point as well. So, but then she said that test indicators were showing possible celiac disease and immediately put me on a gluten-free diet, which I've been doing very diligently for the last 7 or 8 weeks. And now I feel better. My energy level is high. My mood is good. It seems to be making a difference, but my diarrhea symptoms have not gone away.
So let's talk about celiac disease, which is really from a wheat, what we call a gluten enteropathy. So the way that it's traditionally made, in other words, the way you make the diagnosis is by doing a biopsy in the small intestine. And that's done through a very interesting little – you swallow a capsule, and the capsule goes down, eventually gets into the small intestine, and they can take a sample of that. So it's sort of – it's a very unusual test, but there's a test that can be done. So because the test is an expensive test to do, and because it's not an easy test to do, we often rely on a blood test which looks at antibodies to the small papilla. They're called villi or little papillas, and these are little things that sort of stick up in the intestine that are necessary to absorb food, basically, and absorb nutrients. And some people develop, if you will, an allergy to wheat. That's basically what it is. And they have a gluten enteropathy, celiac disease being one aspect of it, the more severe aspect. So I don't know what blood test you had. You may have had the blood test that pointed that way. And generally, if you're on a gluten-free diet, if it's really just a gluten enteropathy, within 2 to 3 months, you should feel much better. The diarrhea should disappear. And if the diarrhea has not disappeared and you're not really all better, I think you have to go to a gastroenterologist. That's what I would do.
And that's what I did do. I got an appointment in a week or two.
Very important.
Do that.
Yeah. If you have to be on a wheat-free diet, which is really not easy to do, if you're actually following it, you want to know whether or not it's really necessary. And good luck on your testing. By the way, you can have – there is beer that is not made with wheat. So
Yes, I have discovered those. There are actually some pretty good ones.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly it. So you can continue to consume beer. You know, it's hard to say that on public radio, but it's the drink of Wisconsin, right? It's either beer or milk.
That's right.
That's
and
all
anything
we
in moderation, of course.
Of course. Yeah. There we
Even
go.
Even in northern Wisconsin.
Thanks for your call.
Well, guys, thanks a lot for your program.
Thanks. Appreciate it. And before a quick break, Zorba, let's take a quick question from Carolyn in Cross Plains, Wisconsin, who's challenging some advice you often give to help alleviate the pain. She writes, besides the matter of compliance, is there some reason why taking two Aleve twice a day is better than taking one Aleve four times a day?
No, there really wouldn't be any difference at all. I mean, it's really a 12-hour drug. So, no, it's a compliance issue. It's easier to take something twice a day than four times a day. But no, as long as you stay below about, 1,000 milligrams of naproxen every day, you're fine. Mm-hmm. That's the top dose. How you take – you could take – one half of an Aleve 8 times a day if you wanted to. And that would work out just as well.
Well, are you looking for an answer to? Just send your questions along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a yummy and good for you recipe coming up. Lots more of your questions, some more interesting research to talk over, our medical myth buster. Plenty of great reasons for you to stay with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. Callers waiting, but an open line right now for you. Before our next call, though, Zorba, recipe time. This one for roasted pear and popcorn salad.
Sounds interesting, doesn't it?
It does.
You know, I can see from your face this is something you're wondering, is this good? What it'll, will it taste like?
Well, popcorn certainly isn't healthy.
Yeah. Well, wait a second. It's corn. Popcorn can be okay. Depends on the butter you put on the popcorn, right? Popcorn can be a healthy snack.
Without butter, it's healthy? No.
No, it can be a healthy snack. So, and actually, the type of popcorn we're going to be using is healthy. It's often the stuff you put on the popcorn has more calories than the popcorn itself. In fact, do you know how many calories are in the big bonus jumbo popcorn that you get in the movie theaters generally?
With butter?
Yeah, the usual stuff that they put in with
butter.
It's
way up there.
Guess how many?
I don't know. 500.
1,200. 1,200 calories is what they are.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
You need.
So we have popcorn?
Well, we're not going to use 1,200 calories. Oh, okay. Here's roasted pear and popcorn salad.
Right.
Two medium pears, halved and cored.
You know, two medium pears, halved and cored.
Yeah, you've got to get rid of that stuff on the inside. 4 teaspoons of olive oil.
4 little pea olive oil.
1 tablespoonful of balsamic vinegar.
1 big tea balsamic vinegar.
1 teaspoon of water.
Little tea water.
1/2 teaspoon of maple syrup and 1/2 teaspoon of Dijon mustard.
Little maple syrup, a little Dijon mustard.
You know, if it read about how they came up with the name Dijon mustard.
No.
The name they came up with was to make it sound fancy, and they could charge 2 or 3 times as much. And, of course, it was a different mustard, and, you know, like it was a special mustard.
Yeah, but it is kind of.
See? You bought it, too. It is kind of. It's mustard. It's just another kind of mustard. Nothing fancy Dijon.
But do you pass it from one Cadillac to the next?
That's what I mean. You've got the advertisement in your mind. That's right. You've got it. 1/4 teaspoon of salt.
1/4 little tea salt.
1/8 teaspoon of white pepper.
1/8 little tea white pepper.
So getting back to that Dijon mustard, you do that with ketchup? You don't think of ketchup as a fancy food. You can't make
somebody's
it fancy.
Somebody's going to come up with a fancy name.
A fancy ketchup, right, to be put sent between two Cadillacs. Yeah. 1 clove of garlic.
1 clove of garlic.
It just shows what advertising does to our mind.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
A shallot minced.
1 shallot minced.
You know, I've always wondered, what's the difference between a shallot and a green onion? Is it like...
Is it the same thing?
Well, it's pretty much, but I think shallot sounds fancier than a green onion. Green onion is kind of like the peasant food, and a shallot is something you have... If you're in Downton Abbey, you would eat shallots,
both
right?
Both of them taste really good,
it's
by
good,
the way.
Good. Now, do you watch Downton Abbey?
Oh, yeah.
Of course. I mean, everyone on public radio watches Downton Abbey. Yeah. 1 package of mixed baby salad greens.
I'm getting confused by about
sorry,
this.
I'm sorry.
A package of mixed baby salad greens.
You've got to have culture when you're making these things. 1 cup of watercress sprigs.
1 cup of watercress sprigs.
Yeah, I think they're called sprigs. You know, watercress. You know, do you ever get watercress at the store when you're at the store and put it in a salad?
I have no idea. It's in the veggies there somewhere.
It's somewhere in the veggies. Yeah. 1/4 cup of dried cranberries.
1/4 cup dried cranberries.
And you could use raisins, golden raisins, if you don't have that.
Oh.
And now get this, 100-calorie bag of popcorn.
100-calorie bag
right.
of popcorn.
Now, as we talked about,
what
generally—
What is that, about 4 little pieces?
No, it's not 4 kernels. It's a bag of popcorn without the oil. Now, we had a popcorn popper in our house that was air pop popcorn, and it was awful. It was just awful. It didn't taste very good at all. But microwave popcorn, which is very popular, comes in 100-calorie bags. It's a smaller amount, and more importantly, it doesn't use the same amount of oil.
Mm-hmm.
So it works. Okay, let's make the salad.
Yeah.
Preheat the oven to 400 degrees. Then in a small bowl, toss the halved and cored pears with 1 teaspoon of olive oil. Place in a baking pan coated with nonstick cooking spray. Mm-hmm. Bake at 400 degrees for 10 minutes. Turn the pears over. Bake another 5 to 7 minutes till they're golden and tender. So you're basically roasting the pears. Then when cool enough to touch, peel the pears. So now you're going to peel them.
Yep.
Thinly slice the pear halves lengthwise. Put it aside. Then in a large bowl, prepare the dressing by whisking together the remaining 3 teaspoons olive oil, balsamic vinegar, water, maple syrup, mustard, salt, pepper, garlic, and the shallot.
Mm-hmm.
And the shallot. Mm-hmm. Add the salad greens, watercress, and cranberries. Toss it to taste. Arrange the pear slices on top. Then pop the popcorn and sprinkle it on top of the salad
okay.
so it doesn't get soggy. So in other words, you're putting a little crunch in the salad. You're only adding 100 calories. This serves four people. So it's only 25 extra calories per person.
It sounds like a good salad without that popcorn to me.
Well, you could. You could, and you could put the popcorn in the side. I mean, but let me tell you, when I went to Nepal, and, you know, I went over the Himalayas.
Right.
One of the foods that we had was popcorn, and we would add it to salad. And we, not salad, we would add it to soup, rather. We had no salads. And it was quite tasty. We, popcorn is a really tasty thing to add to other things in your house.
I must not like it very much because I never have it at home. The only time I ever eat popcorn is in the movie when it costs like $9 a bag.
That's right. Right. Exactly
but I have it with butter, and I like it a lot, but I can't transfer that. I don't transfer that.
Does Monica eat popcorn at home?
No, neither one of us.
See, now Penny loves popcorn. She would eat popcorn breakfast, lunch, supper, 7 days a week.
Anyway.
She likes it. But for those popcorn lovers, put the popcorn on top of the salad and think about popcorn on top of your next salad or putting it in your
salad. And with or without popcorn, you can always get this recipe by...
By going to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can look at this salad recipe. You can look at our other archived recipes at zorbapastor.org. You can look at pictures of Tom and me on that, too. And you can download our podcast. And don't forget, we're on Facebook.
You just scared a lot of listeners away. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. On we go now, Zorba, to St. Augustine, Florida. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, about a month ago, I was traveling for business, and my husband and son were sick, so I had read, I think, in a beauty magazine somewhere that if you swab antibiotic ointment in your nose, not Neosporin, but something like bacitracin, because you can get allergic to Neosporin. Anyway, that, as you breathe in germs, will kill the germs and you won't get sick. And I was wondering what you thought about that, if that was valid.
Wish that it were so simple. That's right. Wish that it were so simple. If it were that simple, we'd all be sticking polysporin, or you said, bacitracin or Neosporin in our nose 7 days a week, or we'd use something called amisoprilin, which is Bactrobam, which is even better. We'd put it in our nose. We'd never get any colds in the wintertime, and life would be great, but it doesn't work. It only works if you have a local infection in your nose, such as a sore inside the nose, or if you've got staph in the nose, sometimes that works. Some people are staph carriers, but no, it will not prevent you from getting the typical infections that we get. So where did you read this, or did you hear about it?
I read it, I think, in like Health Magazine or one of those. I think Health or Shape, one of those magazines.
Yeah.
There was some makeup artist that swore by it and told all her clients to do it.
Yeah. You know what I find very interesting?
Makeup artist.
Hey,
if it's
a credential.
Makeup artist,
it must be real. Yeah. But you know, some people get...
Well, anyway, you look good.
No, and you, that's right. There, you've got it. That's right. You look good, and that's what counts, right? Oh,
well,
thank you so much. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
About 4 months ago, my ears started ringing, and they haven't stopped ringing since.
Can you link it to anything? Did anything happen? Loud noises or anything?
No, the only thing that I can link it to is I had a bad tooth infection that I let go for a long time. And then I had it fixed. And but they started ringing after I had it fixed. Mm-hmm. So it's not really loud, but it's loud enough that it causes a lot of anxiety.
Sure. No, no. Ear ringing, which is tinnitus, can be very, very uncomfortable. A couple of questions. What, years ago, were you around loud sounds, jet propulsion motors, mowing the lawn all the time, rock concerts, working in a subway, those things that can damage your
working
ears?
Working on a radio station with a headset on blasting in your ears?
No, I wasn't. I mean, mowing the lawn, I suppose I've done, but nothing not I wasn't a landscaper or anything.
Okay, no, but those are the important things, because tinnitus can actually often means hearing loss. That's usually what it's associated with. Did it happen suddenly, like one day you didn't have it and the next day you had it, or was it a gradual thing that simply worsened over time?
And no, it just suddenly happened. I mean, one moment I didn't have it, the next moment I noticed it, and then I just never stopped noticing it since.
Okay. Well, a couple of recommendations. First of all, number one, you could just have a hearing loss that goes on. I would recommend that if you have insurance and you can get a hearing test, that you get a hearing test. That's the first thing. Have you noticed that you're hard of hearing at all, or does the ringing just bother you when the room is quiet? That's when it usually bothers most people.
Yeah, no, I haven't noticed any hearing loss or that I can't hear things very well. It's worse at night. I definitely sleep with a fan now.
Got you. That's exactly what it is. What you want to do is you want to get an evaluation. So you want to go to your doc. That's step one. You want to see whether or not there's fluid in the ear that may be causing it. And there can be something called a cholesteatoma. Cholesteatoma is actually a tumor. It's not a cancerous tumor, but it's called a benign tumor, meaning it's not cancer. It grows in the ear and it can produce ringing. It can produce sound differences. It can also produce dizziness intermittently. There's something called Meniere's disease. Doesn't sound like Meniere's disease. That's often a drop in hearing and often dizziness that's associated with it. But there can be things that can be fixed with this, especially if there's inner ear fluid or middle ear fluid rather. So I think I'd get it checked out. If you haven't had a hearing loss, getting an audiometry evaluation is not going to help you. But you do want a doc to look in the ear and say what's going on, and then make a determination as to what tests that can be, you know, should be done. I definitely, if it happens suddenly, I would have it looked at. If it happens for someone who, you know, has been to lots of rock concerts, worked in a radio station, other things, happens gradually, that's a different issue. How old are you?
I'm 30.
30. Got to get it checked out. There's something going on with your ear that is causing this, and you need an evaluation, especially if you're turning on a fan at night. That means the tinnitus is definitely significant. So get thee to a doc.
Okay. Do you think it has anything to do with my jaw? Is that a possibility or
no? No, I don't think so. I can't link them together in my mind how that would occur. So I think it's just coincidental. That would be my initial thought. There are times that these things can be linked, but you got to have somebody look at that ear and figure it out.
Okay.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for your
call.
I appreciate the call. And whenever we get a hearing loss question, I point out that I had the ringing in the ears.
Right.
And it went away.
Right.
So sometimes
it can go on a long time.
Sometimes it can go away.
And you say
that that's connected sometimes to hearing loss.
So you really brought up a good point that a lot of these things change with time. At the age of 30, you want to make sure there's
that's
nothing
too
going
young.
On.
Yeah, that's too young. Yeah.
That's young. Well, you know, because you've been 39 for so long, then that becomes a difference.
How long have I been 39?
Year after year after year.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And Zorba time now for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc. On a recent episode, you reassured a listener with cold sores not to worry about transmitting the herpes virus 1 below the belt. A lot of folks were concerned, and one in La Crosse, Wisconsin wrote in to say this, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I am a 51-year-old widow who was recently diagnosed with herpes 1. I was dating someone who had cold sores but told me that they were not transmissible. Well, when I was diagnosed with herpes below the belt, he couldn't believe that he could have given this to me, but a blood test proved his was identical to mine. To make matters worse, a few months later, I tested positive for HPV. Please advise your callers that this is not a black and white issue and is not to be taken lightly. Thank you."
And she's 100% correct. And I went back, looked at that, and that was, she's 100% correct. So let me give now the correct advice.
Okay.
Because I've looked it up. First of all, the HPV is a separate viral illness that is not connected to, herpes type 1 or herpes type 2 cold sores. HPV is basically a sexually transmitted disease. And that's a separate virus that is transmitted that we know is associated with cervical cancer. Getting HPV doesn't mean you're going to get cervical cancer. Most women clear their body of HPV. It's just something that we look for, and it's important in terms of the Pap test. So let's put that to the side. Now, what about herpes cold sores? It turns out that generally type 2 is below the belt and type 1 is above the belt. However, you can transmit HSV-1, which is the herpes simplex virus 1, which is from a cold sore in your mouth, into the genitalia when you engage in oral genital play. There's no doubt about it. It's not a common transmission. It's not a rare transmission. It's in between rare and common. In other words, it can indeed be the case. And the unfortunate thing about it is that you can have an HSV-1, or herpes cold sore virus, in your mouth even without the sores actually being open. So in other words, once you get cold sores, and most of us have had cold sores, you can still have the virus there in the mucous membranes getting ready to erupt prior to eruption, and you can transmit it at that time. In other words, so it's a transmissible disease. Mm. So I'm glad that the listener wrote it in so that I could correct this information. Yeah. It's very good.
Yeah. And if you disagree with the doc, send your rebuttal to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have an interesting topic to talk about. We have more of your calls, of course, and our medical myth buster, too, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls at 800-462-7413. After we talk, Zorba, about teen birth. Good news, I would think most people would say teen births are way down in this country.
Well, they're very good news. So let's look at the numbers first of all, and then we'll talk about the whys. Mm-hmm. Put it into perspective. So teen births fell 8% between 2010 and 2011. That's the latest data. That's a big drop. But when we look at it, since 2007, it's dropped 25%. They're actually down 50% since 1991.
50%?
Huge amount. But it's still quite high. Let's look at the numbers. It's 37.9, 38 per 1,000 teens. There are 38 pregnancies in the U.S. Russia has 30. The U.S. is quite high. Britain has 25, okay? And Switzerland has 4.3.
Whoa.
So in other words, the number is dropping dramatically, but the number is still quite high. It's still very, very high for developing countries.
Is this a function of birth control?
Well, there are a lot of things involved here, and there's no one thing. And when you look at the data, there are people who will say a number of things. First of all, we know that abstinence, teaching abstinence without teaching birth control, is a failed concept. That has been scientifically proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. Yeah. Just saying, just don't do it doesn't work.
Well, now, abstinence obviously works.
Right. Abstinence obviously works, but teaching it obviously does not work. Yeah. Now, however, there's been a drop in when teens first have their first sexual encounter. So it may be that there was an offshoot of teaching and talking about abstinence meant maybe I shouldn't have sex now. Maybe I should put it off for 6 months or a year. In other words, that
issue. So teaching abstinence does work. Then.
Well, it may have had an effect on when the first sexual encounter was. But more importantly, as you get older and have your first sexual encounter, you're more likely to use birth control. That's the issue. And if you use birth control, and condoms specifically, very important, the first time you have sex, you're more likely to use birth control every time you have sex. That's one issue. Mm-hmm. The other issue is the CDC has recommended hormones for women at the onset, and progesterone implants that last for years have now become very, very commonly used. Depo Provera, a shot that lasts for months, better than the pill because you don't have to remember it every day.
Uh-huh.
That's another factor. The final factor that's going to figure into this now is that with the new healthcare legislation, the Affordable Health Care Act, birth control pills will now have no deductible. That will make a huge difference because all of a sudden, instead of having to pay $5 or $10 a month, that is beginning to make an impact too. So all of these things, cultural changes, birth control changes, which birth control you should use, have all added up to fewer teenage pregnancies, and that is a laudable goal. being a teen mom is hard.
1-800-462-7413. And to the phones we go now, Zorba, with a listener in Almond, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I am a 60-year-old woman. I'm very active, mm-hmm. and sometimes I need to use something to help with muscle aches and pains. I do a lot of outdoor stuff. I have outdoor hobbies, and I have a tree farm that I work on. And I just had a question for Dr. Pastor, because a long time ago I figured out on my own that if I take NSAID drugs, like Aleve or ibuprofen, I get canker sores in my mouth.
Just curious, what are you taking now instead of that?
I take arthritis-strength Tylenol at night. And then if I have pain that Tylenol won't handle, I will take a Tramadol.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a few things involved here. First of all, Tramadol is a drug that is it's not quite as strong as hydrocodone, but it works quite well. Very commonly used in Europe, not used in the U.S. Prescription drug can be habit-forming, but it really is very, very low on the habit-forming scale. So Tramadol is a good drug to use after Tylenol for people who cannot tolerate NSAIDs. I think that is a choice. That is an excellent choice that you can see if that works. So I applaud you for trying that. Now, anti-inflammatories, I would try them again and see if it happens every time. It may be that you're just intolerant of it. It reduces anti-inflammatories work by reducing prostaglandins. They reduce inflammation, but sometimes inflammation is important to fight infection. And, you know, your body may have the cold sore virus in your body that then produces these little ulcer things that are very, very painful. On the other hand, it might be that if you take yogurt at the time that you're taking an anti-inflammatory, it will work, because yogurt with live culture has lactobacillus. It's really a natural probiotic. And you may find that actually reduces what is going on. So I think you've got a couple of options here. But I would try it a few times to see. It may have been coincidental, and it may have actually been caused by the fact that it's an anti-inflammatory. And if it is, then you have to stay away from it.
Okay. You know.
Is the Tylenol working okay?
The arthritis strength Tylenol is wonderful for just aches and pains. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how about the Tramadol? Yeah.
Tramadol is excellent.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I get such good pain relief with Tramadol, mm-hmm. and I never take two at a time. Mm-hmm. I get virtually none of the psychic effects. Mm-hmm. I don't like Vicodin and those drugs. I don't like that high feeling and
for some people that feeling makes them euphoric, and for other people it makes them dysphoric. In other words, and it happens on the whole, if we make a generalization, which of course is always bad, but we make generalizations and rules of thumb all the time, young people tend to see it as euphoric and they like the feeling. And as you get older, that out-of-body experience where you don't have control tends to be uncomfortable. In other words, you like it when you're younger and you don't like it when you're older. And that's a very common thing. Tramadol is a different type of a drug. Full disclosure, years ago, I did some research on Tramadol. I spoke about it when it was a name brand drug. It's a generic drug. Mm-hmm. And it's very commonly used in Europe. I found it very popular, and I found it a useful drug to speak on it. But as I said, I did research on it and was paid to do research by the pharmaceutical companies. But I think it has a place. And now that it's a generic, it's cheap. And so it has an even better place now that it's not name brand. So take care. Okay. Use it judiciously.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. We appreciate the call. You taught me a new word. Dysphoric. I've never heard.
Oh, dysphoric. Yeah, dysphoric. There's euphoria, which is the high feeling.
And dysphoria?
Dysphoria is when you don't like the feeling. That's exactly
it. And dysphoria,
it's an unpleasant feeling when you're out of control. And when you think about it, I mean, I don't drink that much. I don't get drunk very much, but I don't like the feeling. I don't mind having a drink or two, but I don't want to have four or five drinks. That's why I don't do it. So instead of feeling euphoric, in fact, I feel dysphoric.
Got it. Time now, Zorba, for our medical myth buster. We know to avoid germs when they're coming from others, but what about when they're our own? I'll let Gary from Warren, Pennsylvania, take it from here. He writes, Dr. Zorba, can a person with a garden variety head cold reinfect himself by coming in contact with his own germs? In other words, could handling a Kleenex prolong my cold? Thanks.
No. Once the virus is in your body starts to make antibodies to that virus. And so you're not going to reinfect yourself with the virus that your body is fighting. But I guess the real question is, let's say that you've got strep. That's different. Let's say you've got a strep infection.
Okay.
And let's say you're going to handle – let's say you blow into a handkerchief. And you find out you have strep, so maybe there's some strep germs in the handkerchief. And then a month later, use the handkerchief. The germ's not going to be there. It can't just live in the handkerchief in and of itself. So I don't really think you can reinfect yourself with a viral cold. I think once you get it, you've got it, you develop antibodies, and I don't know how you could reinfect it. I don't really think you can do that. So I would say no, you can't reinfect it. And I do know one thing, that if people have other data, they're going to write in and tell us.
You think,
right?
Have an infectious myth? Our inbox is immune, so send it along an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. Our next caller, Zorba, is a listener in South Bend, Indiana. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Well, it's kind of a curious issue here. I have a good friend who probably 6 months ago was in a fight and was told that he broke a couple of the bones in his hands. And he had an option of having a surgery to fix them and reset them, but it wouldn't guarantee it any improvement in the range of motion nor hurt it in the long term. But it was one of the surgeons said that the setback would be as if he didn't pursue a surgery, then he might have some arthritis later in life in his 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And so he opted not to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple months went by, and we noticed a couple weeks ago that his hands were blue as a Smurf.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just curious what was going on and encouraged him to go to the doctor. And I don't think he's gone yet, but I figured I was listening to you guys a couple weeks ago, and I call in and see what your thoughts were on it.
Well, first of all, I like the concept as blue as a Smurf because my son Eli loved the Smurf, so I can just picture as blue as a Smurf. I don't think the blueness of his hands has anything to do with the arthritis.
Really?
That's Raynaud's phenomena, and that's a common phenomena not associated with arthritis. It's where when our hands get cold, we get a vasospasm, which is a reduction in blood flow to the terminal digits, and then they can become blue, they can become white. Separate issue, the treatment for that is basically to glove or double glove. Because their medications are not very good and they can affect it. So I don't think the blueness of his hands has anything to do with it at all. Now, on to the arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
That's always a difficult question. You know, when you've got arthritis, do you have surgery in a particular joint, especially in the hand? You might get arthritis whether you have surgery or you don't have surgery. You know, any injury in your hand, banging your hand, bumping your hand can produce arthritis later on. So it's not as if surgery is going to prevent arthritis from occurring later on. And often with joint surgery, especially in the hand and the carpal bones where there are eight little bones there, you only have the surgery after other things have failed: physical therapy, occupational therapy, anti-inflammatories, splints at night, splints during the day. And the reason is the surgery can be painful and doesn't necessarily work. You know, that's the problem with the –
Can I ask, is his hand restricted, his movement in his hand?
The first, 2 months probably afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been fine now. I mean, total activity, full
Good.
Range of motion.
Good.
Doesn't experience any numbing.
Excellent.
Nor cold.
Excellent.
So that was the oddest thing. I mean, it was pretty warm. I mm-hmm. mean, the blueness comes on regardless of the temperature surroundings. It's not like it's only when it's outside or mm-hmm. when it's cold. So uh-huh. that was why it was kind of...
Is he on any medications at all?
Nope.
No. Uh-huh. Well, as I said, Raynaud's is usually from cold, so I can't explain why his hands turn blue when they're not associated with cold. I can't explain that because it's a cold weather issue. There are some medications that can do it, but he doesn't have it. Does he smoke?
No,
oh.
not at all.
Oh. Well, you have stumped the doctor when it comes to Smurf Blue. I have no idea, but that doesn't mean that it'll develop into anything worse. That's sort of the main bottom line issue. That much advice I can give you.
Well, that's the reason why it was kind of the motivation is like, well, is it a where we got to kick them in the butt and get them moving to see somebody, or is it something that just figure it out as it goes?
I think figuring out as it goes makes a lot of sense. Let's pain be the guide. That's the issue. So.
Oh, that's a good one. Okay.
Thanks so much. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Yep. Before we head out for the day, Zorba, time to take a little tip from a listener who I think you'd get along with. Wayne from Wisconsin called in with a mustache-related solution for leg cramps. I'll let him explain. He says, hi, Zorba. People always talk about pressing under the nose to get rid of leg cramps or Charlie horses, but I have a cure that works for those with mustaches. Pinch your lip horizontally, hard under the nose, and then grab a chunk of your mustache. It will help every time. So what do you think, Zorba? Can a handlebar help cure a Charlie horse?
You know, next time I get a Charlie horse, because I have a mustache, I will have to try this folk remedy and see whether or not it works. I've never heard of it, but hey, certainly worth trying.
I would guess it would work because you would hurt yourself so much by pulling on your mustache that it would mask the pain
exactly
that you're getting from the Charlie.
You got it.
Have you ever heard of this, pressing under the nose to get rid of leg cramps?
Never. Never at all.
But I mean, you muffle a sneeze.
I don't muffle a sneeze by putting my finger under
your
nose.
Oh, it works.
Have you tried it?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
It does work.
Really? Well, what do you think about the leg cramp thing then? You give me advice.
Well, sneeze. I mean, the nose is right there where your finger is.
So what do you think about this for leg cramps?
Makes no sense to me.
Well, Tom says it doesn't make sense, and therefore Dr. Tom said no. But you know what? If you've got a mustache, you might try it anyway.
Have a handy tip stashed away. Send your advice along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We'll see you next time, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And, of course, we're on Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting you to be around for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0309Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.